Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, welcome to another edition of Speaking of Reliability. This is Adam Barrett.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. Hey, Adam. It's been a while. Good to talk to you again.
It has been a while. I've been on the road, but in a really good way.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. Yeah. So for fun, I take it then.
Yes. Working the whole time, but for fun, was able to, we counted it, get the kids in 4 weeks were spent time in 10 different states. And so definitely a lot of chaos and good time.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. And this wasn't all in the Northeast where 10 states is, it's a weekend drive. You were out in the Midwest in the big states.
You're making fun of New Englanders. Yes, yes. Yes, the big states, the big empty states. Yeah, no, I'm not even counting the ones we just drove through. I'm counting the ones like we spent time and did stuff in. But the real core of the trip that was fantastic was Colorado, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, you know, all the canyons and caves and all kinds of amazing things. And so super fun and gave me lots of ideas for writing about different things. But
cool.
Yeah, it was a really good trip. So
cool. Well, just recently, while you were away gallivanting across the country, one of our listeners wrote in what appeared to me to be a simple question, but it's something that I suspect she's struggling with. A new reliability engineer, new position, and in a company, and started just looking around for field data or reliability data of any kind about the products that they make. And other than pass-fail at product tests in manufacturing, didn't find anything really that we would recognize as being time to failure related type data. And so the question was, how do I go about convincing these folks that I need to collect this kind of data? And so I rephrased it how do you convey the value of having data? Essentially, then she can make the argument that we need to invest to get this information because it does X for us and some benefit for us. And so I'll throw you in the deep end here, Adam. How would you approach that kind of question? You know, you're a new engineer. They're not in the habit of collecting this stuff and probably don't understand why you would want this.
Right. So yeah, this is, as a new engineer, I remember being in those situations, and this is you ask the people with decades of experience, not because they're smarter, but because they have a huge catalog of things they've experienced. And this falls in the category of not reliability engineering, but social engineering. You're passionate, excited about your discipline, but you are not going to get anybody else excited about it. Somebody who's in, you know, R&D, or, you know, they're on the invention side to create a new feature or something, or manufacturing, you know, they're not going to get excited about the reliability part. But they have the equal excitement about their discipline. So the trick is to identify two things. And again, this is just how I would approach it. The two things you want to identify is how could this serve something that's one of their immediate goals? So not the data because why you want it, but show them the value of data to satisfy something they want, right? It's much easier for you to adapt what you're trying to generate to serve them than trying to get them to understand what it is you're trying to, you know, what you want to do.
And then you achieve this, if they see the benefit of it, it actually helps them achieve their desired outcomes, whatever
is
that. You end up getting the data you need.
Exactly. And then the second thing is to figure out how to truncate it to be small enough to have value, but yield quick value. Because especially with data collection or designing, you know, either a data generation or data collection process, it can be pretty far out by the time you get all the information you want and then are able to process it and turn it into something. It definitely, you know, takes some work to have it yield not just data, but information that's been derived from it in a short time period.
So would you call that like a quick win kind of thing?
Yeah, you can. I mean, that's a little bit demeaning to it, but exactly. It is definitely a, you know, a, exactly a quick win, a, you know.
Well, I've also heard it called a beachhead approach. You find one, let's say you find shipments and returns, and it's the only thing you find, and you go manually tabulate it. And in the afternoon, you come out with, well, here's a Pareto of, or here's a first pass analysis of this. It's by no means perfect. It's not excellent data, but immediately you can see product X is twice the failure rate of product B. And here's the five main reasons. And that's immediate actionable stuff, right? And it shows that, oh, we need to pay attention to this, or this gives us useful information. And then you can build on that saying, you know, if we had how often it was running, or what kind of conditions it was in, or, you know,
right,
or automated this, then it wouldn't take all afternoon to do it.
Right.
You just get a start, show exactly that it's useful, and then go on from that.
Yep. Right. And yeah, the holy grail is when the person, let's say that you connected it to, is able to advertise it as their idea.
Yeah,
it's that right. You know, it's always seems unintuitive to want to give away the credit, but if it becomes their idea and something they get recognition for, guess who's going to be coming to you with funding to get more? Right.
That's right.
Don't even have to ask anymore. Like, so that's really the holy grail, is to where you slip to the sideline, nobody even knows, and you become the person who can deliver something they want. You're not asking anymore, you're providing.
That's right.
And that's where all of a sudden people show up with, look, here's, I got this budget set aside for this. Like, I've had that kind of surprise where I thought, you know, there's somebody I was pushing for something kind of similar. And then, you know, we had some experiences with, you know, I kind of had to drag them along and keep nagging, but we got, you know, it done. We kind of got a win. They saw the value. And totally unexpectedly, a couple of months later, we just were talking about stuff and they're like, oh, by the way, I put in the budget for next year, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, whoa, okay. So I had no idea that they'd seen so much value in it and that it had served them so well that they actually requested budget for it.
Yep.
Unbeknownst to me.
And that, yeah, like you said, that's the, but you know, this sketch you just laid out here of how to go about doing it is really a change management technique, right? It's, if you want to get something done, look for what you can do that's immediate, what's in it for them kind of thing, the other person you need on to fund it or to support it or whatever, and let them take credit. All those are techniques I've heard around any change management kind of thing.
Yeah.
All right. So in reliability work, I think one of the things you talked about, you mentioned, is that to really, like, is this product meeting our financial goals, for example? Well, you got to launch the product and ship a bunch of them, and then wait for the finance guys to sort it out. And it takes months, if not years, to really know if it's working or not. That's a longer term investment. So if you can scratch up any kind of data, you can get towards those quick insights of what's going on. But what's the value? I mean, so just about every company I've ever worked with looks at their field data in one form or another. Some actually pretty badly, or poorly, I should say, whereas others were doing a much better job. Yet I've never had pushback on the value of that, which was kind of the center part of this question that we got, was, well, how do I convince them it's useful to look at it? So let's answer that question.
Sure. But you're saying useful to, so, I mean, you're talking about field data. So you're saying a product that's out there, and to convince them it's useful to look at, the people you're trying to convince, I'm kind of going to go back to what's important to them. So a recent, you know, it's funny you ask it, because it's very recent in my mind, even from just a few days ago, being in a meeting. And this is actually going to lead into something we talked about that will probably be our next podcast, but finding your adversary to work together to create balance in the force. But this individual was entirely responsible for a new technology being developed in what has been historically a very non-innovative type product. So it's a company that's been around for 50 years. Their technology has always kind of gone these small evolutions. They're kind of realizing they're having to make some, you know, bigger changes. Things are changing. And there's something new that's being done that they have no experience with. And this one individual feels entirely accountable for that. And effectively, if they don't hit these milestones of development, it'll just get cut, right? So it's almost being treated like a startup within the company. It'll just get cut. So that's all he's worried about. He doesn't care, you know, to talk about reliability is crazy. But what if you could, you know, in the meeting say, okay, so this new thing you're making, what are you worried about it with it not working? Because really when it comes down to it, developing a new feature, they're worrying about it not working, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's a reliability thing, right? So ask them the question, what is it exactly you're worried about? And he's like, well, I'm worried about this, you know, this
feature
thing.
Set X and, doesn't and, do Y.
The right exactly. Times, yeah. If it doesn't do this, we're at the next phase gate, we're toast. They just are going to cut it, disband us. We all go on the, you know, fired different projects, whatever.
Well, yeah, there's a natural question I would ask in that circumstance is, well,
right.
What could cause it not to work? I mean, is it process variability? Is it material variability? Is it design tolerancing? Is it, I mean, is it wear out or corrode? I mean, we have lots of ways for it not to work. Well, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Exactly. So that's what I did is the funny thing was that he, you know, as soon as he said that, I said, well, here's what my first tool, if you asked me right away, I would want to apply that, you know, this type of testing. And then he said, okay, but I don't care about that. I just want to know this. And I kind of really brought out the definition of reliability. I said, you want to know reliability, but I'm like, under what use case? And he's like, oh, that's a good question. You know, like this. And before we knew it, he was walking away with the action items to define use case and all these inputs for a test protocol that now he wanted to do because it was going to answer the question, you know, that he was worried about.
Well, that's why you studied jiu-jitsu for so many years.
Exactly. It's the chess game, right? That is exactly what it is. Exactly. Let them lean forward into it. So I mean, by the end of the conversation, what I wanted to do was a key part of his next big deliverable now, right? Mm-hmm. And it was getting tied into it. And so it was, you know, like I said, it was, I found out, I started with what was on his mind. I connected to it. I offered a tool that would generate information, answer a question he wanted. Of course, it's going to demonstrate the power of the tool. And I also made sure it was a tool that wasn't like, you know, reliability growth that goes on for months. It was a derivative basically of Hall testing, really, to get down to. It's something that once you execute in a few days, you have information. And then I tied it to a specific part of the program with a specific gate that they were coming up on. So it wasn't open-ended. Mm-hmm. And he walked out with he was excited about figuring out the inputs we needed to make the tests.
So. Well, what it did is it took it beyond just a theoretical or a bench test to a stress test that gave him better, faster information. And right. You know, so let's say if you're looking for this reliability data and try to show that it's useful, if it's in the product development stage, oftentimes I need to know what's not working, right? Yep. That might be what's of value. And I just need to know sooner than later. And another one I ran into is a program director that, or engineering director that was, a quarter of my engineers are working on past products that are failing in the field. And I want my engineers back. They should be working on the next product kind of thing.
Right.
Well, let's not have as many product failures, you know,
right.
You know, let's look where those are coming from. And some of them were in their design. And so things like derating and just doing stress testing to sort out where those failures were. And he goes, oh, okay, that makes sense. Why should I wait for the customer to tell us where the problem is? We could figure that out ourselves. Oh, okay. That would allow me to do it when it's way less expensive to make those changes. And my engineers would not be pulled away for these, and he used air quotes, emergencies, you know, every week to go solve field problems and deal. And he's like, oh, okay, that helps me get my job done because I can have predictability of how many engineering hours I have.
Right.
Kind of thing. And other people are like the finance guys. They're always like, well, I just wanted to know. It was funny when I talked to a number of finance people over the years about what was important about reliability to them. And they said, it has to be predictable. We set aside $100 every month for estimated what we're going to pay in warranty. And if it's $90 of actual payments, we wasted $10 in a bank account that wasn't really working for us. If it was $110, we lost profit. And I thought, oh, okay. It's not exact. They didn't care how much the warranty was. I think somebody at some point would care about how much, what percentage you're paying. But they wanted it to be predictable and consistent so that it was they could set aside $100 and we paid out $100. That was an interesting insight. So I think the short answer to this question is really, you got to figure out who's going to use the data that you're collecting. And it can have many, many different uses. Everybody from the finance folks to product mixes and do we enter a new market or not, to development and how do we use information to make decisions today. I mean, even things like selecting a vendor, you could use reliability data to influence those decisions. But you got to connect it to those very concrete, real things. And you outlined a handful of those.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing, too, is that be willing to also have it not be the data you wanted to go after or mm-hmm. the question you wanted. Right. It's a little bit hard because you start advocating very hard for what you want. But be willing to be flexible and have it shift, because the question he wanted the answer wasn't the one I considered the most important, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
But I adapted saying, okay, well, maybe we'll use this tool first, even though that's not what I was worried about. There's other things I want to do, but that's because I'm looking at a much bigger picture. You know, I'm used to the long-term return on investment. Right. But for him, it just was getting to show this function worked consistently at this next phase gate. So they don't cut funding. That's the way it worked in his mind. Right. So I'm not getting answers to the questions exactly that I want now, but we are getting answers to questions. We're demonstrating good tools, and he might surprise me and be the guy that puts money in the budget for me to, and then he'll also take my advice. I'll be like, well, we should do this. And he'll be like, all right, you know. So be willing to be flexible is a key component.
And it's also, you know, take the victories where you can. I think don't be upset you don't get everything. Is that if you're making progress towards it, yeah. you're in better shape. The other piece of this is that oftentimes there is data out there that you can tap into. And I'll give one example, though, of I was doing an assessment with this company and I said, well, how do you track your field failures, your product returns and stuff? How do you manage that? And they said, oh, it's simple. Every month we count how many products we ship. And they were making these little disposable unit type things. And so they'd ship like 10,000 or some odd number around that number. And then we count how many products are returned that month. Well, how long does your product take to get to your customer? Oh, a couple of months, and it has a shelf life of a year. And so when do your customers know it doesn't work? It's, well, when they use it. So do any of your customers get the product you ship in January and find out it doesn't work and return it in that same month? No.
Right. Yeah.
And you see where I'm going with this? It's like,
oh, yeah. Yeah. It's actually worse than no data. It's bad data that if you use to steer what you're doing, you're just going to be driving wildly all over the place.
That's right. As soon as you start shipping a product and ramping it up, you know, and you've got no failures, nobody's used the product yet. You know, things are great. We got a really high reliability. The numbers are great. Keep doing what we're doing. You know, and then failures start coming in from those early batches. Heaven forbid that it's a class defect or a batch defect that affects a high percentage of products. Now you're really exposed because you got it all out there already.
Yeah.
And they start going, oh, reliability is going down. We got to fix this. And they run all over the place. They change a bunch of stuff, but it might only be a 1% problem. But compared to where they were before, it was, you know, they couldn't tell. They couldn't tell at all. And they were using this. Basically a bar chart, the percentage of returns versus the shipments of that month on a chart, and it would just be volatile. And okay.
I bet we could do a whole episode on crazy metrics we've seen. It just messed up metrics. It's funny when you said that, one that popped in my mind was a company that as I was evaluating, you know, and they had this, you know, I was evaluating, you know, their failure modes and their field stuff and their tracking, trying to get help. And one of the highest ones on there was this specific, you know, component. It was listed as that component. Everyone was like, oh, this component's horrible. It stinks, mm-hmm, you know. And it actually, when I dug into it, had never failed. It was actually like really, in my mind, hands down the most reliable part in their system. It was amazing. It only had one moving part. And it had like seven different functions. It just blew my mind. It was basically the equivalent of taking like a you know, an internal combustion motor that has a, you know, a couple hundred moving parts and replacing it with an electric motor, right? Mm-hmm. Has one moving part. How's it going to break?
Right.
So this thing was like that. And they even had a design plan in place to make a replacement for it that had like 12 moving parts as opposed to this one to do the same function. So when
why were they blaming this part?
Here's the thing. This part had a function in it where it would serve itself as a mechanical fuse when something else didn't work right. So it's like blaming the circuit breaker for the wire short. So what would happen is the part would sacrifice itself as designed when something else went wrong in the system. There was a specific thing that went wrong, and it would sacrifice itself so as not to
They'd reset that fuse, essentially
they throw the whole thing out. So basically, it was the customer had to do a rather difficult assembly process, and there was a lot of things that had to line up. And if this thing didn't line up right, it sacrificed itself so it didn't damage the more expensive mm-hmm. part on the other side. So they always were blaming it for you know. So I was like, not only is it highly reliable in its function, it's doing exactly what it's supposed to do in assembly, and you don't have any failure. The fact you have no failures on the mating part on the other side shows how good this thing is. And they were about to undo this amazingly reliable thing and replace it with something that had like 12 times more degrees of freedom of motion of stuff, so guaranteed to be less reliable. And so, yeah, I'm sure we could do a whole episode on crazy things we've seen with metrics and ways of measuring what's going on. But yeah, sometimes it's amazing. And once that was pointed out, they were like, oh my God. But they're so used to this part name had almost become a curse word because it was always at the top of their
Radar. Yeah.
At the top of the radar. And it's because it was sacrificing itself to protect it from another problem had nothing to do with it.
No, there's a whole nother couple episodes in this one. It's reminding me, I was working with one group on a FMEA, and this one guy said, you know, let's make sure that part's failing is not because it's the victim or the hero. The fuse is the hero. It's like your part you just described would be just, he would call a hero. It takes the hit for something else going wrong. It's not its fault. It was an innocent bystander kind of thing, or that's a victim, right? The energy had to go somewhere. And hit this part. Or the other one was the instigator, which is the part that caused the problem. That's the one you really want to fix. But it was a cool way of thinking through this type of stuff. But anyway,
Funny thing is, doing the analogy with this. The funny thing I just remember too with their analogy with the circuit breaker and fuse is one of the things they did, I found out, was they increased the threshold for taking the hit. So that's like having your 20 amp fuse breaker blow and you put in a 30 amp to solve the problem.
Yeah.
Like there's still a wire short somewhere.
Yeah.
It's really funny. It's so funny what people do. But
There's a whole show just on solve the local problem and not look at what's going on. That's so typical. It's actually one of the paradigms that we get trapped into pretty often. It's part of our role is to step back and say, wait a second, guys, let's look at this. Yeah. So the data, the primary value of reliability data is to enable good decisions. You know, so that you make the right decision, whether it's picking a vendor or sizing a component or introducing a product line into a new region. Those are all reliability-influenced decisions, and having good data behind that, whether it's field data or test data or simulation data or whatever, helps you and your team, more importantly, make better decisions. And I think that's where the real value of it comes from. So you just need to line up the data collection requests that you're making with where somebody needs that to make a decision. And then Adam outlined a handful of steps to make that possible to keep in mind as you do it. Yeah. So I'm trying to think. We haven't talked in a while. You mentioned before we got on air, Adam, that you were working on a book. Are you going to put a date out there when it's going to be ready?
I will.
Not yet, though, huh?
Okay. Not yet. I'm not going to put a date out there yet. I want it. It's very important to me. I feel like it's not just another book because it's about reliability culture. And you know, so much work I've been doing in there, and I don't want to rush it because the work I'm doing, you know, in that on that topic is constantly expanding and continuing. And, you know, I find myself making new tools. And as I'm engaging with, you know, customers on this, you know, it's something that's new. I just feel it growing and growing. So it's almost, it's hard to say, oh, okay, that's it. I'm just going to put this in here. So I really want to let the whole thing get a little bit of a level of maturity. So because of that, it might take a little bit longer. I was originally thinking possibly could be the kind of thing like, you know, the end of this year, earlier in the year. And I'm like, no, there's more to be developed. So okay. I will put a date on there at some point, but thank you for mentioning.
Not yet. All right. Well, for the listeners, if you'd like to prompt Adam to get more out about this book he's working on in this concept. And I know Adam and I have talked about reliability and culture in organizations quite a few times. But send him a question or send him some ideas at the ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. It's a page we've set up just to get feedback and comments and also questions that we most likely will talk about on future episodes. So again, that's ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and look forward to hearing from you. So with that, Adam, I think we'll wrap this one up.
Yeah, that's good. I hope people are able to apply those, you know, simple steps to kind of getting that small win and helping that person. And then maybe you find out they put you in the budget for next year.
That's right. Yeah. Always good.
Yeah. Right. All right. I'm glad we got to talk.
Yeah. Cheers.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.